Our gracious Father and our God, we acknowledge and we honor your presence, and we declare that you are our most cherished guest. Thank you for yet another opportunity to gather in such a place as this in recognition and celebration of a people that you created. Indeed, we have come this far by faith. It is through celebrations such as this that we are reminded of our journey, of our reach, of our tries, of our successes, and all that we have accomplished. Not so much that others will know who we are, but to stand in testament and remind us of who we are. So as we contemplate all that we hear on this day and over the 28 days of this month, let us be assured that no matter the trial, no matter the setback, no matter the hiccups in the road, and no matter the thorny trials, that we are well able to navigate the dark places and the uncertain times because we have come this far by faith, leaning on you, Lord, and trusting in your holy word. We know that you have never failed us yet. But as importantly in this time together, let each one consider how an appreciation of our commonality and of our shared life experiences can make us better because we are better together. Amen.
Amen.
Good afternoon. First of all, I'm Judge Jeanette Ogden, and I'm the chair of Women in the Courts Gender and Racial Fairness Committee. We're one of the sponsors of today's Black History Program. And on behalf of Justice Paula Firletto, our administrative judge who could not be here today, and all of the committees who are sponsoring this program, I would like to welcome you. I would like to acknowledge the presence of our presiding justice of the Appellate Division, 4th Department, Justice Gerald Whalen, and all of my colleagues in the judiciary. Let's give them a round of applause. I would also like to acknowledge our Erie County legislator, Barbara Miller Williams. Pastor Blue, the president of the Buffalo branch of the NAACP. And importantly, I would like to thank all of the program participants, particularly Dr. Catherine Collins, our New York State regent. Because Black history is American history. It's not just about the stories of people and events that happened years ago. It's a living history, one that can guide our actions and prevent us from making unnecessary mistakes. So this year's program focuses on the crucial role of education in the history of African Americans. We all understand the implications associated with the denial of access to knowledge. And we welcome Dr. Collins' remarks on the crisis in Black education. African American history has been examining that issue for centuries, and the legal system has been a part of it, from the landmark decision of Brown versus Board of Education to the campaign for fiscal equity. We have been examining this struggle. Addressing the crisis and Black education is one of the most important goals of America's past, present, and future. And welcome Legislator Betty Jean Grant, who has just come in. Again, on behalf of all of the committees and members of the court, I thank you for sharing this time with us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Lenora Foote Beavers, and on behalf of the 8th Judicial District Diversity Committee, I'd also like to welcome you here today. We would like to thank our sponsors of the program, and we would like to allow them just a few minutes to share their remarks regarding Black History Month. So first, I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Krangle, representing the Western New York chapter of the Women's Bar Association.
Thank you, Lenora. Good afternoon. I'm honored as the president of the Women's Bar Association of the State of New York, our Western New York chapter, to be here with you this afternoon. I was asked to give some brief comments about why Black History Month is important to the Women's Bar Association. The Women's Bar recognizes that many of our members are confronted not only by gender discrimination, but also by racial discrimination. This past August, our chapter of the Women's Bar adopted a diversity plan. The objectives of that plan being, one, to promote full and equal participation in the chapter, the legal profession, and the justice system by all persons, and two, to eliminate bias in the legal profession and in the justice system. I would be remiss if I did not extend a special thanks to the amazing Lenora Foote for putting our diversity plan together and really spearheading that initiative. Thank you so much. The theme of today's program, Crisis in Black Education, brings to mind the late Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to the House of Representatives and a representative of our great state of New York. Her career in politics was preceded by a career in education. She became known as an authority on issues involving early child education and child welfare. To borrow a quote from Shirley Chisholm, "In the end, anti-Black, anti-female, and all forms of discrimination are equivalent to the same thing, anti-humanism." It is that spirit and sentiment in which Black History Month is very important to the Women's Bar Association. And in the spirit of promoting diversity and inclusion for all, the Women's Bar is very proud to be a sponsor of this event today. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. And unfortunately, David Embins and Stephanie Calhoun, who represent the Minority Bar Foundation and the Erie County Bar Minority Outreach Committee, are unable to be here. If they are able to come in later, we will have them make their remarks later on. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Judge Deborah Givens, Buffalo City Court, and it is my pleasure to introduce today our distinguished guest speaker, Dr. Catherine Fisher Collins. Catherine Fisher Collins earned her doctoral degree from SUNY Buffalo. There, she also earned a master's degree in allied health education. She is a graduate of Trocare College School of Nursing and Buffalo State College's Nurse Practitioners Program. Dr. Collins is a respected author of many published books, including Sources of Stress and Relief for African-American Women, The Imprisonment of African-American Women, Causes, Conditions, and Future Implications, First and Second Editions, African-American Women's Health and Social Issues, First and Second Editions, African-American Women's Life Issues, Today's Vital Health and Social Matters, and Black and Adolescent Girls' Life Challenges. In production is her first children's book, Bullying, It's Elementary, The Eve and Jesse Story. 6 years ago, Dr. Collins launched Women's Health Radio, the only radio program in Western New York with a focus on women's health. Dr. Collins has held positions in healthcare as well as educational administration, and she has served as the director of a registered nurses program. Dr. Collins is the recipient of numerous honors and awards, including community service awards from the governors of both the state of New York and New Jersey. Dr. Collins currently serves as the first woman and first African-American representative of the 8th Judicial District on the New York State Board of Regents. Her appointment was confirmed by a joint session of the New York State Legislature on March 10, 2015. Dr. Collins is a proud mother of two children who reside in Texas, Clyde A. Collins, a gastroenterologist, and Laura Harris, a former Buffalo Public School principal. Dr. Collins credits her love for education to her late parents, Herman and Catherine Fisher, who instilled in her the value of education and the love of reading. Her motto is, "The future of this nation is in the hands of public education." Here to address us on the crisis in education, I am pleased to present New York State Regent Dr. Catherine Collins.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Judge Givens, for those very kind words of welcome. And to the organizers of this event, Ms. Foote and Judge Fiorello, I am honored to have been selected, that you selected me this year, to be your 2017 Black History Month speaker. It is indeed my pleasure to present to you my views about education with emphasis on African American children. First, I will present some critical factors within the educational and social system that I believe has had significant impact on Black children's learning and achievement. And I will follow with suggestions of what we can do about it. You know, you always hear all the problems, but no one tells you where the solutions are. So I'm going to come up with a few solutions for you, and they're not, it's not a long list, but it's a list of things I think that we can all accomplish. One way to measure educational success is by how many kids graduate. In 2013, according to the Pew Foundation, 46% of white children were adequate readers at the eighth grade level, while only 17% of African American children were adequate readers. These are the children who are on their way to high school who lack the foundation in reading. How do we expect students who are not adequate readers upon entering high school to read a high school textbook, to read or solve a math problem? And furthermore, given these statistics, how do you think these poor reading skills will affect high school graduation? You don't need a scholar to answer that question. You just need common sense. Consider the data reported. State Education Department reported graduation rate for African Americans in the United States is 72.5%. In New York State, African Americans, it's 64.6% for that cohort who entered the schools in 2011. And in 2012, here recently, it's 67.7%. And in Buffalo, now those were the state statistics. Now in Buffalo, for those kids who entered in 2011, the graduation rate was 57%. For those kids who just graduated, now it's 61.9%. So it's creeping up, but it hasn't made it to the level where we should say 80 and 90%. 3% is unacceptable. It is also reported in the literature that children who read experience increased problem solving, increased ability to concentrate, increased attention span, increased decision making skills, and a host of other benefits. This is how important reading is. During the time of slavery, if you taught a slave to read, it was a death sentence for you, the teacher, and for the slave. Through reading comes knowledge, and knowledge is empowering. Denying or prohibiting the ways of one to acquire knowledge, and we disempower a human being to becoming whole and productive and free from obstructions of success, which so many children in general, but specifically for African American children, encounter. My dad graduated high school and my mom completed eighth grade. They both could read. When something in the Fisher house needed repair, plumbing or electrical, my dad would read a book and make those repairs. He passed that skill on to my brother, his electrical skills, and he became an electrician. I believe that one of the keys that can open the door to achievement is reading. Through this important skill, we learn how to pronounce words, interpret, and respond to questions. I believe that the deficiency in reading skills has had tremendous effect on the academic placement of African American children into special education classes. In Western New York, we have 32,000 students in special education, in which the lack of ability to concentrate, a deficiency in their attention, also are essential issues that may many of these kids end up in special ed, some of them African American children. As I pointed out early, reading has been reported to increase one's ability to concentrate, focus, and pay attention. When I served on the Buffalo School Board along with Betty Jean Grant, who's here, she can attest to it, Dr. Williams and the board, we put in a block of reading time. Every day in the city of Buffalo, kids were reading. They were reading, and then they would turn their attention to math. We hired reading coaches to help our classroom teachers. All too often, we see our educational system place these children in special education classes where medication rather than meditation is offered to help them to focus. I just sent out an article to some of the educators in the regions as well on how meditation can help these children rather than giving them a pill. And I'm also very concerned about the fact that this medication that we're giving them is not predisposing them to the possibility of later on participating in drugs that are sold on the street, and you know we have a heroin epidemic. The brain is still forming, 17 years of age, and when you start futzing around with the pleasure centers of the brain, you predispose a person to wanting to feel good all the time. So therefore, I'm so opposed to medication and being a school nurse when I started my career. I know how these children are given medication because many of them come from environments where they can't go outside. They can't be safe in their own homes, more or less out on the street. And then they come to school and they're antsy, they can't sit still, and people say, oh, they're hyperactive. Okay, let's go get a psychologist. Let's get this kid tested. Let's see what he is doing other than just sitting there in the classroom, not paying attention, and not really paying attention to what is going on, because many of them, again, have not had the proper medical attention that they need as well. Enrollment in teacher education programs is down nationally and locally. It has been well documented that teachers who are new to the teaching profession, I'm saying new to the teaching profession, primarily are white, and therefore less experienced, are sent to poor neighborhood schools where resources are not available and the support of a master teacher is not there for them. According to Project Pipeline Repair Grant, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, one of the programs that we have similar, before 1954, Brown versus the Education Supreme Court decision outlawing school segregation, African American men and women constituted a significant measure of teachers in the pipeline, particularly African American communities. Following this historic court decision, 38,000 African-American teachers lost their jobs. There were severe decline in the number of African-American students enrolling in education preparation programs. And the new teacher certification and admission program requirements contributed to another loss of 21,500 black teachers between 1984 and 1989. To become a teacher is very costly, and the requirements following graduation continues to be costly for the teacher. Here in Buffalo, the starting teacher with a bachelor's is $38,000. With a master's degree is $43,000, and overall, the overall salary is $1,000. And what we're doing with these teachers also is we're telling them you have to pass 4 certification exams, repay financial aid, and within 5 years you have to have a master's degree. All of this costs money. According to the Learning Policy Institute nationally, 8% of teachers are leaving the profession. And this is also undermines the students' achievement. As I previously mentioned, when African-American children come to the educational system with academic deficits and because their classroom may be assigned to inexperienced or substitute teachers, this lack of continuity in classroom instruction also puts students at a disadvantage for success. And to make matters worse, according to the Policy Institute, we're facing a shortage of teachers in 5 years. We will have a teacher crisis in 5 years. And some of them are leaving, those 8% I mentioned, are leaving because of the finance, because of the poor salaries of some of them, and because of the fact that they have to pay back all of their student loans. Add to this the fact that special ed and bilingual teachers are already in short supply, not to mention math and science teachers. The U.S. Department of Education stated in their report, 40 states are reporting shortage in special education teachers. 42 states are reporting teacher shortage in math. And 30 states are reporting teacher shortage in English language learners. These are but a few of the many educational barriers. Now let me turn my attention to the social barriers to education and learning for African American children and for children. Racially speaking, Black and white income have not improved and therefore will continue to have a devastating effect on the quality of life, including, of course, education. An analysis by the Pew Foundation in 2014 that showed their taxes, and also when you compare 1967, where whites' average income was $44,000, now in 2014 is $71,000. And for blacks in 1967, the average salary was $24,000. And now in 2014, it's $43,300. When you do not have a living wage, you do not have the ability to purchase health care, nutritional food, and of course, books. Now, low-income houses are relegated to the poverty status. And according to the National Poverty Center, 12.3% of white children live in poverty, but 36% of African-American children live in poverty. I was fortunate to be raised by a two-parent household. That afforded me the opportunity of a high school graduated father who worked while his wife stayed home and took care of the 4 children. He and all of his friends wanted a better life for their children, and knew that education would be the key to success. My parents instilled in us the love for reading, took us to church on Sunday, and had us to read the Bible. We did not have the distractions, however, of what our children have today. The video games, the texting, the TV, all of those are distractions in terms of education for them in their homes when their parents could be, if they're literate, to help them with their reading and writing. In 1960, 74% of the white population was married, as in contrast, 61% of African Americans. And according to the 2014 census, 55% of the population over the age of 18 were married, so therefore, and 31% of black families were married. So now we have many of those young people not married, and therefore they're single, and they have to help their children. It appears that children in this nation are being raised by single parent household, another factor that contribute to poorly educated black children. For these single female-led households experience poverty, low-paying jobs, and the lack of education on the part of the parent is very significant and an obstacle. In Erie County, we have over 40,000 persons without high school diplomas, and therefore many of them are parents, How do we expect them to sit at a kitchen table, work with their kids on Common Core reading, Common Core math? Some of you, if you've looked at the Common Core reading and math, you know it's difficult. It's very difficult, and it is a problem, especially if you do not have the grasp of reading. Now, here are ways in which we can help. The first teacher for all of us in this room were our parents, our moms and dads. They were the ones, I believe, that if they were literate and could read, they hold one of the most important keys to academic achievement and for African American children. If they can read, when we sit at a kitchen table with their children, they can help them to capture the information that needs to be digested, and they can explain to them. As I mentioned earlier, there were 40,000 people in Erie County without high school diplomas. In our district now, we have community schools. We've established parent centers where parents who are not literate can go and become literate and have a diploma if they choose to sit in those schools that are now being kept open until 7 o'clock at night and on Saturdays. So parents really can go to school and make sure that they are able to know the information and get the help. Some cities have even gone to Sundays to keep the schools open, because we know parents are busy too. We can't put it all on the parents. We know that many of them are poor, and they're out there working two jobs. They're out there trying to keep a roof over their head, and they're out there trying to make ends meet every day. Now, even though we have single parent headed households, many that these children come from, I was a single parent for a long time. But you know, you have to make those sacrifices. When my husband passed away, I had to make those sacrifices. And parents have to know that they have to make the sacrifices. Sometimes you can't do all the things that you want to do. You can't go all the places that you want. These children depend on you. We have to get these parents who are single back into the classroom. We have to make sure that they have high school diplomas. In our state, our governor's State of the State address in 2016, he said that America went from number one worldwide to number 16. What happened? What happened from number one to 16 worldwide? There are many things that has happened. In the past, when I worked in the criminal justice system and looked at the planning for prison cells, we used to look at fourth grade reading levels. Does it tell you how important reading is? Fourth grade reading levels. And I recently looked at something that said now the prison cell planners are looking at second grade, because this determines just how many kids are going to be floating around out there doing the things that they shouldn't be doing and end up with some of you. At the state level, we have established an Office of Parent and Community Engagement. This office and its personnel will work closely with our teachers as well to help them with the kids, as well as the parents who are in these offices, and they're receiving a little stipend to help them. One of the hardest things for me when I was a school nurse, because I started out as a school nurse, was to get the telephone number from the parents. They just didn't want to give you their phone number for a variety of reasons. And when a child was ill and I needed to take them home, I need to call the parent to make sure that someone's there. So by putting these parent centers in, by putting parents in those centers, maybe they will develop a better relationship with the parents of those kids in that school, and they would be willing to give them their phone number. We have had so many reforms. We're now in another reform. This last reform, No Child Left Behind. Now we have one, and with the new Secretary of Education, we're hoping that it continues. It's called Every Student Success Act, or ESSA. The State Education Department will submit a plan that addresses the high underachieving schools and it will include a strong parent component to which the feds will hold us, New York State, accountable. And I will be there to hopefully make sure that we do keep them accountable. The Buffalo District has just received a large grant that's called My Brother's Keeper. This is a program that President Obama started. He wanted to focus on African American and Latino males. And so we have given this city, with a lot of the other cities in this state, money so we can put in teachers, role models, and individuals who can come into the school. So these kids need to see people that they can aspire to. If they only see the people that sometimes, and this is, you know, that the press show on television, you know, they used to say, if it bleeds, it leads. But we have to make sure that we see the positive role models. People like Damone Smith, who was our councilman, who volunteers now as a scout leader for St. Martin de Porres. He gives up his time. You could start a book drive here in the courts. I take books to schools when they ask me to speak for graduations. I take books and I put them out on the table outside the auditorium. And I tell the parents, please take them. Please take them home. And I'm always collecting books. So you can collect books here, and when someone asks you to come to a school, take some books. Show the importance of reading. Not always on a Kindle, but all you pick up a book. Okay. This book drive could really help a lot. Also, when someone like Catherine Collins comes to you and asks you to please write a chapter in her book, and this is my latest, and I have requested and I received a wonderful article on an issue that we're all dealing with, from Judge Juanita Bing Newton, and I heard a presentation by her this past weekend. She wrote on raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York, a judge's observations. And you certainly have observed a lot that should be written by. Don't just share it amongst your colleagues in the court system. Share it with the community. And, of course, here locally, I had another dear friend who wrote a chapter on African-American adolescent females in the criminal justice system, and that's my own Judge Ogden. And she spent a lot of time writing that chapter for this book. And so when people ask you to share your expertise and the information that you have, of course, it will make a difference. I want to mention just a program that's in its early stage of development, and that's with Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples-Stokes, the Teachers Aid Union for Buffalo, and two of our university and colleges, because we want to develop a career ladder for our teaching assistants to teachers. We need to have monies, so those young women and men who sit in our classroom, who bring the diversity, the most diversity to our school system, are those individuals and who know a lot about the children and their families. We want to develop a program so we can move them up the ladder, because it means that we're going to have this shortage in 5 years, and we need to do something about it. It appears that, you know, it's very low voter turnout in our school board elections. It's a sign of apathy. And when you go out, if you could just take the Cat in the Hat with you, because he is one vote, two votes, one vote, you vote. If you could just read that one book to the kids to get them started towards thinking about how important it is. Now, in the high schools, we register the kids to vote before they leave. So we need to start early on with these kids. We need to start when they're in kindergarten, getting them ready to vote, because we get what we vote for. Alan Pope, former NFL Minnesota Vikings, now Supreme Court judge, founded the Page Education Foundation Scholarship for Poor Minority Children. And he gets, as he said, the great satisfaction out of his students who received their funds when they come back as lawyers. And one of his students, who he provide resources for, has become a counterpart of mine, Minnesota Board of Regents. Malcolm Mitchell from the New England Patriots said that when he went to college, that he was reading at the junior high school level. And you know, I always give people credit when they talk about their deficiencies, because a lot of people won't say that. And he did, because I want kids to know that you can come in with these deficiencies, but it doesn't have to stop you. Now, he has written a children's book called The Magician. And he was in a Barnes & Noble. He was walking through. And this white female saw him and said to him, would you like to join my book club? And he did. And so he's the only African-American male there. The room is full of white females who are reading books. And I think there was maybe one woman of color in that room. But he goes out and he talks to the kids. He reads his books. He gives them a book. Reading is the key. Believe me, reading is the key. I just had a conversation with Thurman Thomas, who is interested in doing something in our schools. And hopefully he will come in and talk about not only football, but about being a businessman, a man who is interested in helping out. Next year, during the month of February, there's something called the African American Reading Chain. Professional lawyers and judges and teachers, and I recently saw Tim Kennedy on television participating in this particular program. So all of you can participate in that way. I firmly believe that we need to continue to be caring and creative about ways in which to help our children. Those were but a few of the things that I think that you can do here in the court that will not cost a lot of money and take a lot of your time. My final word comes from Carter Woodson, who once wrote, if you teach the Negro that he has accomplished as much good as any other race, he will aspire to equality and justice without regards to race. Thank you for your kind attention.